It's time to begin our Wednesday Bible study here at Trillicoochee. We appreciate your presence here this evening and the presence of those who joined us by means of the live stream. We are studying in James, the third chapter, and we'll begin with the ninth verse. My special thanks to Brother Steve for teaching the class last week in my absence. I listened to it and quite enjoyed it. It helped to prepare for where we will begin this evening. Third chapter of the book of James is a chapter that begins some practical application. Suffice it to say that much of the third chapter really is going to address the point he makes in verse 1. But it must be understood that the things that he says in the rest of the chapter are not limited to those who are teachers only, but the application is for all disciples. I do not intend to cover verses 1 through 8 again, but to begin with verse 9 this evening, in which James writes and tells us with regard to the tongue, and that's the instrument he's using or the term he's using to describe our speech. We know that it isn't our physical tongue that does the thinking and the speaking for us, that those things actually come from up here in our head. We think those things, and then they come out from out through our mouth. The simple use of the word tongue is just a metaphor for our speech, the things that we say. So James writes, with it, with the tongue, the antecedent of it is tongue, we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. And for each one of these verses, In my notes, I wrote down a little heading for the verses. And the heading for this verse is the question, do you kiss your mother with that mouth? That's a saying that's commonly used in response to people who like to use profanity. They'll use those foul words. And so the question, do you kiss your mother with that mouth, is to demonstrate that I'm aware that what you're saying is trashy and filthy. How can you, with that mouth, speak to someone else and then speak kindly or kiss your mom? So that's the point that James is making here. It's the hypocrisy, yes, the absurdity of using the same organ or the same means to bless God and curse beings made in the likeness of God. Now, what I want to open for discussion is the question, why is it that it's a problem, not just for us, but a problem for God, if we bless Him in one conversation and curse other human beings in another conversation? How does this create a problem for God? We know it creates a problem for us, but how does it create one for God? Yes?
Well, since he says that we're made in the image of God, then what is happening is we're cursing those likenesses of God. We would be cursing, you know, Jay said something a couple of weeks ago, in God's, we are special. God, he made the reference that God made us and we are special. And when we curse, man cursed that special creation of God, I mean, God has all the same, we have a lot of the same attributes of God. And we, men would be cursing those.
That's it, what we're doing. One of the two things that we create as a problem for God is that first, we are impugning God who made humankind. It is, as you put it yourself, it is a criticism. If we're criticizing a human being, we are criticizing the one who made that human being. So it impugns God's nature and God's character as the creator of the person we're cursing. What's the second difficulty it creates for God? Conflict, yes.
Well, it would also seem to me that it's kind of comparative to sin. He can't be in the presence of sin. Therefore, if you're blessing him, but on the other hand you're cursing those in his image, what good is that blessing?
Right, because he can't draw near to us because of the sin of maligning or speaking evil. Good point. I didn't have that. That's a good one. I didn't have that in my notes. Kind of wish I had. The second one that I was looking for, which will now be the third one, is that how can God trust us? You know, that's what I would say. You know, I'm going to see it from God's perspective. When he hears someone curse another human being who was made by God to be like God, how can he trust them to be sincere when they bless him? How can God trust me to be sincere if I'm cursing other human beings? Because the other human beings I'm cursing are just like God, so he can't trust me. Let me put it a different way from my perspectives. Let's suppose that Jay comes up to me and says, "I hate all conservatives, but I like you, Paul." That creates a problem because I'm conservative, so how can I trust you to like me? You've already said you hate conservatives, but you like me. That's a conflict. James is saying, how can we curse men who are like God and bless God with the same mouth? How can God trust us? We've already demonstrated that we would speak evil of human beings made in the image of God, so how can he have any confidence in our praise of him? The answer is he can't. So now for three reasons we learn this evening that when one uses the same facilities to bless God and to create harm for other human beings, we are demonstrating that we cannot be trusted and that all the things that we might consider are good about ourselves are called into question as a result. Yes?
How about if you've got a guy over here in organized crime that's a convicted murderer, just an evil guy,
mm-hmm.
and yet he stands up in court and says, "Yeah, I've done all these things. But that fellow over there, Paul, I like that fellow. He's a good guy." That carries no weight.
No, it doesn't. In fact, I would be suspicious. I would be very suspicious. Sometimes the worst, how do I put this? The worst criticisms that can be offered is to have somebody evil like us. So that's a very good point. So this point is titled, "Do You Kiss Your Mother With That Mouth?" How can you bless God and curse human beings? It's just not possible. Verses 10 through 12 of the reading. Verses 10 through 12. Max, would you read that for me? That's in chapter 3 of James 10, 11, and 12.
Out of the same mouth proceed blessings and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Though the stream send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening, can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Does no spring give both salt water and fresh?
Okay. In verse 10, he restates the problem, and then beginning in verses 11 and 12, he gives some examples. He gives two illustrations of his point, and we reason from nature that this isn't going to work in nature, and we are part of God's design. We are part of the same creative effort of God who makes the world and sets it in order with rules. He makes human beings and sets us in order with rules as well. And if it's against nature, then it would also reasonably be against nature for us to do the same thing. You know, it's just not possible, as he makes the point in verse 10, out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. These things ought not to be so. In fact, they're not possible in any sense. Think about it for a moment. I'll use my hand to shake the hands of disciples at church on Sunday, and the rest of the week I'll use that same hand to slap my wife. The question then becomes, is can we consider him a good person at all? No, not even the fact that he is using his hand to extend fellowship on Sunday, it can't be trusted. Because he has demonstrated that he is an evil person. James really wants us to understand, at least this far in the reading, is that you can't take good and have an admixture of evil in it and consider there to be any value to the good. If I have a bucket of white paint, and I put a tablespoon of black dye in that, black colorant, I put a tablespoon of black colorant in that bucket of white paint. Is it white paint any longer? No. It's going to be off-white or gray or something else. It's going to have an admixture of evil. When the Old Testament prophet was criticizing the people of Israel, he explained to them that it's not possible for God to redeem you. I'm talking about the northern tribes. It's not possible for God to redeem you. He said, you are corrupted silver. Some silver mines that they had back in those days, the silver would be alloyed with some other natural mineral that could not be extracted by any means they had. And what God is saying to them is that you have an admixture of evil in you that's not going to be able to be extracted by any means. You are corrupted silver. Yes, it's silver, but you can't do away with the evil. And so in this context, he wants them to understand they may do good things and say good things to God, but because of this evil they have in them, their good has become evil, even though it appears good. Steve?
In this first hand it says, these things ought not to be this way, which indicates that we can control the tone.
Yes.
And we can control our thoughts. And that helps to have us to be able to have a way of thinking. We have a mindset.
Yes.
That we are thinking. That way we can control our individual thoughts and then we can control our tongue.
I would say that that comes with maturity, but that's also something that all disciples should work toward and develop, is a level of maturity. For example, you know, there used to be, Art Linkletter had a show about kids saying the most unusual things. At any rate, and it was an interesting show, some of the things they would blurt out, and it's because little kids haven't developed a filter. They haven't matured enough to understand that some of the things they're saying really shouldn't be repeated in certain circumstances, or ever for that matter. And so it is that, to me, that illustrates those who are new in Christ versus those who have worked to mature. Controlling the tongue is a difficult thing, and that's what James acknowledges earlier in the book. It's hard to do that. But he's telling us that this is something we could come to, as Steve was pointing out. It becomes something over which we have control, and we should work toward that. Anything else? Yes?
It makes me think of the situations that are going on in the world right now. Everything seems to be a divide. There's a difference between everything. And you can have people that are meaning well, but if they open that mouth and say something that normally wouldn't be an evil thought, but they're just comparing themselves to somebody that's looking at something different, it can sure come across evil, and it can sure get us in trouble with God.
See, that's two things. Well, I'll just talk about the one aspect of that, but the fact is that one can intend the best and word it as carefully as possible, and there's still someone who's going to be upset or offended. You know, sooner or later, somebody's going to find a way to take offense at it. So the difference between that kind of speaking evil and the kind of evil speaking that James is talking about, in that particular kind, the evil is not in the speaker. The evil is in the hearer. And there's where the problem lies. And over that, we have no control. But what we can do, as Paul told the Philippians, is live blamelessly, without harm. And if someone wants to take offense at an honorable thing that we've said, that's on them. And there's not aught we can do about it. Anything else? Okay, then he uses the two illustrations that were read earlier by Max. It is the spring and the trees, or the grapevines and so on. The spring, he's talking about the same fissure or the same crack in the ground or orifice from whichever the spring flows. You know, we're not used to this. We don't understand this. And the reason is because when we go to the tap to get water, we can pull one, and it's cold, we pour the other, and it's hot, and it comes out of the same spout. So, you know, that's a little difficult for us to grasp this. What he's saying is that a spring that only gives forth fresh water, if it gives forth salt water, it's not a freshwater spring. Even if it gives fresh water intermittently, it can't be trusted to always deliver the spring water. So, and the same thing is true, especially if you go back to the cities of Laodicea and the two cities on either side of them that you see addressed in the book of Revelation. Laodicea is criticized because their water is lukewarm and certainly not pleasant. On one side, the city was famous for its hot springs, the city on the to the north. The city to the southeast of Laodicea was known for its cold, clear springs. And both of them had advantages. Laodicea was in the middle, and they had putrid, lukewarm water. It just wasn't good, and it had that sulfur smell. That's what happens when you try to blend two things that aren't meant to go together. You like the hot, sulfonated water because that's good for your bones, you know, and you can lay in a tub with that, and people often took the waters of that city. Or you can get to the cool spring because I'm thirsty and I need something to refresh me. But at Laodicea, you were stuck. Drinking water that was neither hot nor cold. Wasn't clear, but it wasn't quite completely sulfonated. It is just bad water. Why? Because it's a mixture of the two. James is helping us to understand that you can't mix those two. You can't mix blessing God and cursing human beings. They don't go together. Because what you're going to get is something unpalatable. Something unacceptable. Fig tree does not bear olives. In fact, it's a completely different tree altogether. Completely different species of tree. The wood's different. The way they grow is different. Their seasons are different. The harvests are different. You cannot go to a fig tree and pick olives. It's never going to happen. And that's James is telling us. That's the same thing with someone who speaks evil of a human being. You're not getting good from that fellow. You're not getting from him what is needed. Or he says, a grapevine bear figs. They're just incompatible. They cannot be reasonably expected. And this is how far the divine is distancing himself from someone who comes to church singing, "Oh, how I love Jesus," and then leaves the building and curses his fellow human beings after he goes home. It's just not compatible. Yes?
And if we're talking about that spring for just a minute, how is our fountain? Is it refreshing to others? Is it an encouragement to others? Is it bringing forth spiritual thoughts or spiritual words of encouragement? And so we have a choice which water from that fountain we get pour forth. It needs to be refreshing to others.
Yes. One of the notes that I had written down here from the author I was reading, he puts, our mouths are governed by the same laws as the rest of creation. It's not full of mercy. Merciful means disposed to show compassion to others as much as is possible. And I really appreciated that because that's what he's talking about in this context. Speaking to others the way God has spoken to us, the way we will speak to God. Speaking with respect for the other's being. We desire mercy from God, and we should realize that because we as a human being desire mercy from God, what does our fellow human beings look for? They're looking for the same thing. They would like to have the mercy as well. And if we, especially if the context is talking about speaking or teachers, then we ourselves must fully understand that we're speaking on God's behalf when we teach. Isn't that what Paul told the Corinthians? We beseech you, therefore, on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. And so our speech must reflect the speech of the divine, merciful to human beings. Okay. Anything else on this section? All right. Let's have verses 13 through 16, please. Jill, if you would, 13 through 16.
Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there.
I've titled this section, Has to Be Seen to Be Believed. And that's exactly what James is telling us there with regard to one's wisdom and one's understanding. It has to be seen in order for it to be believed or in order for it to exist. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it. Let him demonstrate it. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in meekness, in the meekness of wisdom. I love that phrase there, meekness of wisdom, but more on that in a minute. It has to be seen in order to be believed. James has already demonstrated in his book so far that he is quite polar in his teaching. It's either one way or the other. When it comes to faith, faith doesn't exist. It cannot be seen in the absence of works. Now James is telling us that wisdom cannot be seen in the absence of, in the absence rather, of one's works or life or manner of living or conduct. So wisdom is not provable. One can't talk about being wisdom or boast about being wise. It has to be demonstrated. It has to be seen in order for it to exist. And then he closes that by his works and conduct in the meekness of wisdom. Sometimes a phrase just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? Okay, now here's the question for discussion. Why is wisdom meek? Why is wisdom meek? You would tend to think that wisdom indicates power and structure and discipline. Why is it meek?
I read this kind of saying, let your good works be seen, but don't do them to be seen.
Okay.
Because meekness implies humility.
That's a principle taught elsewhere, clearly. And there, meekness implies humility, but meekness can be humble because it has substance. In this particular case, the substance that is the source of the meekness is wisdom. Let's back up a little bit from that, just a moment. Wisdom is meek because it doesn't need to boast in order to be recognized as wisdom. Wisdom doesn't need to advertise that it's wisdom. Wisdom that is that wisdom can be meek because it doesn't have to boast or be talked about or advertised. In this particular case, the meekness of wisdom is manifested in a life that is lived, as he says there, by good conduct and works done in the meekness of wisdom. Here is someone who is wise, and it's evident to those who look at the life that this individual is a wise person. He doesn't have to advertise it. She doesn't have to talk about what she knows or what she understands. It is seen. It's one of those things that we're drawn to sometimes without thinking. Sometimes there's a person in our life, perhaps a little bit older, in some cases maybe younger, but there's a person in our lives that we just admire, and we know that if we have a difficult question, that's someone we can talk to. How is it that we came to that conclusion? They have a sign around their neck, I'm a wise person? Do they have is it on their business card? Nobody has business cards anymore. Is it on their Facebook page? You have business cards, Scott. No, they're not advertising it. How is it that you came to know that this person was wise? Think about it for a moment. What is it that draws you to this person to say, I have a serious personal issue I need some biblical counsel on? What draws you to this one? It's his or her manner of life. They are living in such a way that you look at it and see that is wise. That's a wise person. They're not talking about it. They're not boasting about it. They're not advertising it or getting a tattoo that says I'm wise. They are persons whose manner of life becomes a testimony. They quietly live this way. Meekness is not weakness. Meekness is powerful. It has the resources to conduct itself humbly. Now, some people are forced to be humble because they have no resources other than their own limitations. But in this case, wisdom can afford to be humble because it has the resources to get away with it. Steve, and then Jay.
In the very first verses of James, it says, those who lack wisdom, ask God for it and He will give it to you. Well, here is one way that it is given, by doing these things and by sharing and asking or being good to others and doing good deeds. And there's wisdom in that, and that's basically showing that first few verses of how it's done.
I think it might be an indicator that that person has a connection with God because their wisdom obviously came from Him. They're sourcing it from the divine and from those things He's taught. Jay.
I think we've all met people that tend to be know-it-alls. That if you are talking to them, they want to tell you they're an expert on every subject. That's the last person you go to for advice.
Right. That's somebody who's advertising. He doesn't, you know, that's why James is telling us there in this passage that wisdom doesn't need to advertise. Let him show his wisdom by his good conduct and the works that he does. Okay, now he's going to give us a contrast here. Verses 14 through 16 is the contrast to it. This is how we know that wisdom does not exist, or the ones in whom wisdom cannot be manifested. And again, I still think he's talking about verse 1, the teachers. But he says, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. Now, I still can't decide, even though I've looked at this for years, I still can't decide if boasting against the truth means lying about how wise we are, or whether it is teaching in such a way to deceive people that we are wise. It might be the second, but even if it is the first, neither one of them is going to be acceptable before the divine. All we do is manifest our envy. And that's what brings someone to boast about what they know. Living up in Pennsylvania, I had opportunity to spend some time in Newcastle and in Lancaster County, and to go a little, and when I lived in Ohio, go up to Bristolville, places where you have large Amish colonies. And I did spend some time with Amish folk, talking with them. Even had an opportunity to study with a Mennonite. It was an interesting experience learning about their approach and understanding. One of the things that you see when they assemble together is that they go overboard with this humble thing. You know, they're trying to decide who's going to lead singing in any given service. So what they do is the person who can talk, who seems to be the least humble among them, is the one who ends up being the song leader. You know, it would be like Scott and myself and Steve and Jay standing around in a circle and each of us saying, well, Jay, you're a much better singer than I am. I think you should lead the singing. And Jay, no, brother Steve has been doing, and no, Scott's got the, you know, each one is talking about the other one, how much better they do it than myself. It is a contest to see who can be the most humble. And one of the things that the fellow in Bristolville said about this was, he says, I think that's probably our arrogance. What we're trying to do is get the other fellow to say I'm being the best song leader, and whoever loses the contest gets to lead singing. It is a manifestation of even those who are trying to be humble and who live humbly, or simply as they put it, live humbly and simply, still have problems with this. They still have problems. If we are competing with one another for the position, and I still think he's talking about teachers in verse 1 in this context. If we are competing for position, whether teacher or any other effort in the Lord's service, and place emphasis on our own ability, It is a manifestation of jealousy, whether we're willing to acknowledge it or even note it at all. We want the position, and so we put ourselves forward either as the teacher. James is telling us, look at the conflicts and the problems that it creates. Wanting to be the one to whom folks come for advice. Envious of those. That self-seeking there is to vaunt oneself up. That's describing someone who has their own interests at heart and not the divine's. And then in verse 15, he describes that kind of wisdom and is contrasting it with the wisdom that he describes earlier in this context. That kind of wisdom, even if the fellow does have knowledge or does have ability, that kind of wisdom does not come from God. That kind of character or conduct or manner of life is not from God. What terms does he use to describe it in verses 15 and 16? What are the terms he uses to describe this kind of wisdom? Other than, first, it's not from above. It is what? Earthly. If you were to define earthly wisdom, what other terms would you use to characterize it so we could understand it? Earthly wisdom is what?
Fading.
Pardon?
Fading.
That's one way. I didn't think of that one. But yeah, it's fading. It's disappearing. But it's of this world. And therefore, because it's of this world, it's going to go away or disappear. Earthly wisdom is wisdom that's this world's wisdom. What did the Apostle Paul have to say about that kind of wisdom? Well, when he was talking about the gospel that he preached, it was not with the wisdom of men. The things that he preached with regard to Christ was not with the wisdom of this world. He wanted them to know that it came from God. So there is wisdom that appears as wisdom to men, and then there's wisdom that is clearly from God, and we need to learn to discern. Yes.
And I believe God looks at earthly wisdom as foolishness.
Exactly the case, in that same context of 1 Corinthians. Okay, the second term he uses, after earthly, what's the second term?
Natural.
Natural or sensual in some of the other ones, that natural or sensual focuses on the interest of the physical body or the flesh. It focuses on the interests of the person, whether we're talking about the pride, whether we're talking about the physical appetites, or the things that we have a desire, a covet for, the lust of the eye, as John describes in 1 John 2. These are things that satisfy the physical man as opposed to the needs of the spiritual man. Sensual does not look at the higher spiritual purposes. It looks for what do I get out of it. The third term that he uses there is what?
Demonic.
Demonic. And from best understanding it can come to is that this is a kind of wisdom that serves the adversary, not the Lord. Doesn't necessarily mean that one who has this wisdom is demon-possessed, but like the demons serve the devil, the adversary, so it is that this wisdom serves the purposes of the adversary. It doesn't serve the purposes of the Lord. It doesn't come from heaven. It satisfies the needs of the physical man, and it serves the purposes of the adversary. This is not the kind of wisdom that we are to be moved or impressed by.
And let's remember the demons recognized Jesus and trembled. However, they didn't change.
No, they didn't change.
You don't want their wisdom.
No. Very good. Now, I think that in this context, though James does not use the term, he is really describing the carnal mind. The carnal mind is at enmity with God. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verses 1 through 3, Paul talks to the Corinthians about their carnality, their interest in the material, in the world, in the physical, in those things that do not serve divine purposes. Also, well, I'll come back to it if we have time at the end of class. These things that he describes in verses 15 and 16, he just wants them to understand that where these spirits exist, nothing good comes. It opens the doors for confusion religiously, and that would be the best thing that could come of it. But actually what comes from it is all things that are evil. So it opens the door to confusion and ultimately to full-blown evil. I thought I saw somebody start to make a comment. Maybe I'm mistaken. Okay. Now, verses 17 and 18, please. Sandy, you're next.
But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace.
Okay. This is almost as stark a contrast as what we see in Galatians 5, where he describes those things that are the deeds of the flesh as opposed to the fruit of the Spirit. It's the kind of contrast that you see between 1 Corinthians 6, about verse 6 and onward from that point, where Paul describes those things that will keep one out of the kingdom of God. And then you see in the opposite end of the spectrum from that, the description that Peter has of those things that we commonly call the Christian virtues. There is no common ground between any of them. It's like reasoning that someone can be arrogant and humble at the same time. That's just not possible. It's like reasoning that someone can be thoughtless and malicious and be loving and gentle simultaneously. They cannot coexist in the same being. Again, James is giving us this polar, this absolute dichotomy here, that it is either one or it is the other. And our emphasis is that we must pursue the right one here. Pursue the wisdom that is from above. Does this mean that we're just never going to act the other way, whether inadvertently or in ignorance? No, it doesn't mean that we're going to be perfect. But what it does mean that in our pursuit of that which is good here, the things he describes in verses 6 or 17 and 18, that in our pursuit of these things, we crowd out and leave little time and room for those other things. Over time, it becomes a practice, a habit or a pattern of life that is easy for us to maintain. Pursue these things. Now, let's break down the things that he describes as the wisdom from above. We've already looked at the wisdom from this world. It is worldly, earthly in nature. It is sensual. It focuses on the interests of the body or the flesh. And it is demonic. It only serves the purposes of the adversary. When we come to the wisdom that is from above, the contrast that is seen is that not only does it bring benefit to the one who has this wisdom and exercises it, but it blesses others. And just as James tells us in verse 16 that the wisdom that is from this world creates problems for others, so the wisdom that is from above, when we practice and exercise it, creates blessings for others. Thus you see jumbled together in these two verses those good qualities and virtues that come and the benefits or blessings of those things on others. Where there is the wisdom of the world, there is confusion and every evil thing. Where is the wisdom that is from above, there is impartiality and gentle treatment of others. Quite a difference. Look now at verse 17. The wisdom that is from above is first pure. Now, I've got about half a page of notes that I have on that particular verse. Let's just talk about it being pure. It is not only innocent in terms of its innocent of harm or innocent of the potential for it, but it is evident that this is the case to all who hear it. When one hears the wisdom of the divine being taught, he doesn't have to be told, now this is the wisdom of the divine. It's evident to those who hear it. It's not only clear that they are, that it is teaching that is free from harm. Still keep going back to verse 1. It is teaching that is free from harm. But it also becomes clear that it is teaching that is innocent of the potential for harm. In other words, the wisdom that comes from God cannot do harm. It can only do good. It is an absolute. It is first pure. Then James teaches us that it leads to and promotes peace. It is first pure, then peaceable. And I think that that's the way we need to understand that peaceableness. It is that which creates an environment in which peace can exist and flourish. Peace we sometimes define as the absence of conflict, don't we? And that's not the Bible use of it. Peace may be the way we define, absence of conflict may be the way we define peace in our time. But the way that's used in the Bible, it is an active condition or an active state. It is a state that actively seeks the well-being and the interests of all. That would be the best interest of all. It's not just, well, we're not fighting, so we're at peace. It's a relationship where we are not fighting, we are at peace, and we are working for one another's well-being. So, the wisdom that comes from above is first pure. It is innocent of the potential for harm. And it creates an environment in which active peace can take place. Yes?
And if you look at that verse, if you work backwards, it's really a farming analogy.
Yes.
You can look at, there's a sower, and the sower is one who wants to make peace. And what does he sow? He sows peace. And that comes up, and what is the fruit of that? But righteousness. So you have this farming.
And righteousness is defined for us in 17 as opposed to afterward, before the fact. That's the fruit we're looking for. Verse 18 is how we get there. Thank you.
In terms of peace, some marquee wisdom that I remember seeing on a church marquee, that peace is not the absence of war, but the presence of God.
Oh! Intriguing. I have to put that in the slow cooker of my mind and digest that. Thank you. Mercy, we are running out of time. I'm not going to consider this chapter finished. Let's make a mark on verse 17 as our beginning point, because there are other things that we could talk about that would be spiritually beneficial to us. We'll start with verse 17. I'd recommend that you do the questions at the end of this lesson for the next class as well.
Well,
yes?
Just real quick, if you look at verses 14 and 15, 16, but then look at verse 17, the contrast, you can see Satan and God. And then you think about, okay, how wonderful is it that the God that created me and everything around me is the latter? His actions are of the latter.
Mm-hmm.
However, my first impulse as a human is to serve the previous.
Why would you say that? I know we're a little bit past time, but why would you say that our first impulse as a human is the wisdom?
Because I want to be self-serving.
Okay, self-serving.
And that's what Satan stands for.
Pursuing the interest of the flesh. The physical man.
Although everything in 18 and after sounds great to me, my impulse is to not be that way. And
well,
that strikes me.
And that's what Paul talked about in the book of Romans. He says, wretched man that I am. He says, my mind wants to serve the spirit. My body wants to chase the flesh. Okay. Good discussion in this class. Really appreciate all the input and the comments. Let's prepare next week to study the balance of the chapter.